You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. My guest this week is Robin Green. Robin Green was an early contributor to Rolling Stone when it was still a newspaper and was the first woman to have her name on the magazine's masthead. She then went on to a career in television, where she had a hand in the development of a little show called The Sopranos, and where she created my mom's favorite show, Blue Bloods. Her memoir is one of the best books ever, and it's called The Only Girl, My Life and Times on the Masthead of Rolling Stone. Robin Green, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So you worked on The Sopranos, which was a show about a crime family, and then you created Blue Bloods, which was a show about a crime-fighting family.
Yeah, it was kind of an antidote. Antidote, yes. You know, just when you spend 5.5 years or, you know, all of the 5.5 seasons of your life with that kind of an anti-hero, we just needed to create a hero. It was really that simple. And we were approached with a lot of shows, but we liked the idea of this one. It really is what we needed at that point. And apparently what America needed.
I want to see a crossover episode.
That would have been great. Would have loved to do it, except that Jane Scandalfini didn't really cooperate, did he?
No, that was sad.
No, that was too bad.
Well, in your book you said that having Tom Selleck involved in the show meant that it would be a success, but also that you wouldn't be a part of it for long. What did that mean? What transpired?
Well, you know, he hadn't been in network television for a really long time. He'd done some work for CBS on special projects, but we wrote the script with Leonard Goldberg. It was Leonard's idea. Leonard was on the board of CBS. I think he just quit. He's one of the 80-year-olds who quit after Les got booted out. But that's Moonves I'm talking about for his Me Too stuff.
Right.
So Leonard was on the board, and Les Moonves asked him, you know, what he thought was missing from television, and so Leonard came to us with an idea that he had that was a brief, that was a rough outline of Blue Bloods. And, it wasn't in New York necessarily, but it was a big eastern city and all of this. So, but it was three generations of a cop family. And Mitch and I had been approached with a lot of shows. As a matter of fact, we were approached with The Americans, but for some reason we didn't jump on it. But, and there were a lot of other things, and including a show with James Gandolfini, but we just, nothing seemed right. And the minute that Leonard said that, we were in the living room listening to him on the phone, and we bought it in like 30 seconds. We just knew we could do it. We knew how to do it. It was just one of those things. So we did it. And we wrote the script, and it took some doing, and we wrote the script, and we sent it out. And Leonard, is a big showman. He created with Aaron Spelling all those shows like, Charlie's Angels and whatnot. So he wanted to bring Selleck back to television. So we sent the script to Tom Selleck, and Tom Selleck loved it. And so we arranged a meeting at CAA, and I don't know if you've been there, but, it's this ridiculously intimidating building. It was like 100-foot ceilings in the lobby, very, very grand, very white. Everything is white. And we were in this white conference room. With white pads and white pencils, and in walks Tom Selleck. Leonard and Mitch and I were there to meet him, and all 6'4" of him, and he just and he loved the show, and he just the minute he came in, it was his show. That's just the way it is. I mean, Leonard understood that. He'd worked with stars, but it was a, I won't say it was a deal with the devil, because he's hardly the devil, but it was either, we knew that he would bring an audience to the show, and we really couldn't think of anyone else that would be better. He was just the best person for that role, and lo and behold, I mean, we doubled their audience on Friday night from 5 million to 11 million at CBS, so it was the right decision for those reasons, and the show is still being filmed. It's just that I came up on television at the time when the writer was boss, and I just couldn't get along with him.
Were there fights? I mean, did you take a bunch?
There was one kind of, no, there were no physical fights, but there was a bad showdown. And it was uncomfortable, I would say, more than anything, because everyone was there, the whole cast. And, you know, we had to apologize and we had to make up, but it was never the same good after that. You know, the show went through a lot of difficulty. Television is rough. Teaching is rough, though. I'm teaching in Iowa now. My husband and I are teaching that course at TV writing just for this semester. It's really very hard also. Well, I guess working is hard. That's why they call it work, I guess.
I know all about teaching, so I know that that's difficult.
Oh, but, you do? Okay.
But I want to know more about this the television thing. But one more thing about Blue Bloods. So there's it's kind of a political stance that Blue Bloods has, I think, or some of the characters do that might be considered more kind of right wing.
I don't know. I think the show always struggles with that. I think that cops, you know, by their very nature, have a certain role in everyone's mind. You know, cops, you know, throughout the country are racist or one thing or another. But those kind of issues are what's argued about at the dinner table. And I don't think anybody, you know, I don't even know Tom Selleck's leanings about politics. I think that issues come as they come, and they're argued according to the character's personal beliefs, you know, or political beliefs or societal beliefs. So that's what we liked about it, was that there was an occasion to debate, to have healthy debate. I think there should be healthy debate. I think that time is past for now. but I believe in different points of view and being able to tolerate them, if they're tolerable.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. No. Of course, there's room for lots of points of view.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't think of the show as right wing, but I have friends who do.
Left wing friends.
I have lefty friends who can't even turn the thing on. So.
Well,
there you go.
And of course, it's still going strong. But you did in the pilot, you. And I'm sure that you calculated this since you wrote the pilot. There's sort of a cop does a repugnant thing. I can't remember exactly what it was, but he beats a confession out of a guy or something.
He has to, because a little girl is going to die. You have to have some kind of clock on a thing like that. So he did what he had to do to save the little girl. And so there was cause for debate, you know, with his. You know, Aaron, his older sister, is a DA, a prosecutor. So, you know, she was not happy with it because it really hurt her ability to prosecute the case. He had to go out and find fresh evidence, which he did, you know, so it all worked out. But that was the debate at the dinner table. And that dinner table scene was 9 pages long in the original script and never changed, which is very unusual at television. It was sheer fun, you know.
A lot of talking.
A lot of characters, but a lot of points of view and a lot to talk about. And it was exciting because there was an argument, you know, and voices were raised. And so
but you could have had a car chase, and that could have been.
I'm sure they have their share of car chases now. I think the show is probably spending a little more money, but maybe they can afford a pretty good car chase now. I think the show's gotten better and better without us, so I don't have a bad feeling about it. And I'm proud of it in its way.
And it still has your name on it every week.
Well, you know, yeah. You know, we own a piece of it, so, you know, it's a nice little annuity as life goes forward.
And there's, I don't know which cable network it is, but there's a cable network that all the shows is episodes of Blue Bloods.
Yeah. No, it's in syndication all over the world. So it's doing okay.
That's pretty great. Know? That's pretty great.
Yeah.
So when you worked on a show like, you know, whether it's Northern Exposure or The Sopranos or this one, I'm always curious about how it works, because you have someone who's writing the episodes, and sometimes it's you and sometimes it's other people, and yet you've got, you know, I guess a showrunner. So how does it work? How do they, does somebody tell you when you're writing an episode, we need this to happen, these are story arc things that happen?
No. I mean, all shows are run differently, but in Sopranos, we were in that story room, four or five of us, all day, every day, from around 10 in the morning till 7 at night, with lunch brought in. You didn't really move from that room. Because you just sit around and you try and work out the episodes. And as you finish an episode, you know, you work on all the stories. David goes to the board. David was very, very active at each and every one of the shows, and we all, I mean, we did leave the room to cast, you know, for that episode, you know, when we had to replace, you know, when Nancy Marchand died, we had to bring in an Infanta's sister the next year. And so you stay in the room and you work out all of the stories and you put the episode together, in which I describe in the book in this very primitive manner that involves strips of paper and scotch tape. you put the beats of the, you know, the scenes in order and you create an episode. Then one of us would go off to write. In my case, the two of us would go off to write, and Terry Winter and David would remain in the room with whatever one or two other writers came and went. Todd Kessler was there, I think, the first 2 years, maybe, and Frank Ranzulli. It was really fun. But it was, again, me with all those men. I don't know how that happens.
I noticed there are quite a lot of women in the credits of the first episode of Blue Blood, so you changed that.
Our line producer, yes, was a woman. And there were a lot of women writers, too. Yes, there were. Yeah, I mean, the scene has changed pretty much, and it changed right away in television. It was just one of those things at The Sopranos where there were very few writers in that room, and they were men, except for me. It just happened that way. But, you know, you also leave the room to go and sit on the set with your episode. So sometimes Mitch would stay on the set with the episode, guiding the director, just to keep the tone even, because the directors change from episode to episode, and I would stay in the story room, where I prefer to be, and then he would come back, and on it would go, and it would just go and go and go. And I think around the fifth season, Matt Weiner came in. I think it was the fifth season, and so that was another person in the room, and you know there was some turnover, but not much. You know, in that first year, we just did it. We didn't even air the episodes until they were all in the can and done. We just did it for fun.
With the idea that maybe someone would see them sometime.
Well, you know, we just didn't know what was going to happen. We really didn't. Mitch and I quit, you know, a really lucrative job to go there because it was only 12 episodes and network is 22 and you're paid by the episode. That's how that works. And so we just did it. You know, our agent thought we were nuts, but we did it because we loved the script. We just loved the show. And when we saw David's pilot that he shot of the show with James Gandolfini, Edie, and everybody, you know, we were in love. It was just a labor of love for that whole year, for everyone, actors too. And then it was a hit. It was a big hit. We knew right away. At the premiere in the sub-basement of a record store in Times Square, just this little kind of screening room. And when people came out, you could just see from their faces that we had a hit. It was just wonderful. It was wonderful. Funny, smart, different. And there it was, you know. Then it was a real ride for many years.
Well, it's been said that The Sopranos changed television permanently in every way. And I think one of the key ways that it changed television was, you know, when I was a kid watching TV, Mannix might get in trouble or Matt Dillon might get in trouble, but you knew that they were going to get out of trouble because just like you knew Gilligan would never get off the island. but in The Sopranos, you never knew. People got killed all the time. People you loved got killed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was shocking for everyone when Big Pussy died.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was. You have to kill people. That's one of the rules of mobdom. You know? Yeah. A mob show. As a matter of fact, when David wrote the pilot, he was about to go into production, I think the story goes, and he, I think this is what he said, and he realized that he had a mob show. He'd written a mob show where nobody got killed, so he made this other plot for Christopher, where Christopher gets into the coke business and ends up killing a dealer, so he could have that murder, so, you know, to satisfy that requirement of mobdom, you know.
Well, you weren't there when the series finally came to an end, but what did you think of the final episode, the controversial
episode? We
weren't there. Yeah.
We weren't there.
Did you watch it?
I did. Mitch didn't. I did. When we left. But we never really watched it after that, and really it had become very mob-centric, And I guess we had bitter feelings as well. But I watched the last episode, and at the time I thought it was obnoxious, but I was thinking about it the other night for some reason, and I thought, well, maybe that's good. You know, it left everybody with a real uneasy feeling. And I suppose that David meant that, to leave people with that anxiety that was always present in Tony Soprano's body, that fear and that sort of nausea of fear of being killed. So it was effective in that way, I think. I don't know what David's thinking was. I haven't really talked to him since.
This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro here on KSEL. We're talking with Robin Green, and she's the author of The Only Girl, My Life and Times on the Masthead of Rolling Stone. We haven't talked about Rolling Stone yet, but we're about to. And she's also the winner of Emmys and Golden Globes and all those things. You know, they have never given me I've never been nominated for an Emmy or a Golden Globe, and I don't understand why, but...
Could maybe because you're not in television?
That could be, you know, that. And... You know, and I'm Jewish. That's probably the thing. Oh, no, but you're Jewish and you got...
No. And Hollywood's, you know, crawling with our type.
You worked at Marvel Comics at a time when, in my life, because you're just a little older than me, Marvel Comics was essentially my life. Everything that came out of Marvel Comics' office was sent directly to me, and I voraciously read it. And so I'm very curious to know what it was like there at Marvel Comics in those days.
Well, so was Jan Winter, you know. Jan had just a sense for what was popular, and boy, he sure called that one, because they, you know, Marvel has taken over everything. Certainly Hollywood, moviedom,
right.
And it's become huge. But then it was, you know, for me, it was just the best job I could get in New York, because I really wanted to be in publishing, and that was sort of close. You know, it seemed lame to me. I wasn't into comic books at all, but I think that that's what interested Jan. And when I told him about Marvel, that I was going to have an attitude of a little about it, you know, a little irony there. But it was a delightful place to be. Stan had a real twinkle in his eye, and the people were very sweet and creative and self-effacing, and probably too much so for their own good. But it was a very buoyant, a happy atmosphere, I think, on the whole. And, you know, I spent, when you're young, you know, 9 months seems like an eternity.
Yeah.
That's what it was like for me. But, you know, when I did sit down with Jan, he asked about Marvel Comics, and that was my first assignment from Rolling Stone.
I've had that issue of Rolling Stone. Of course, I have a ton of issues of Rolling Stone, but I have that one with the Hulk on the cover. And
in
fact, my copy is in much better condition than your copy, apparently.
In my life, it's like a miracle that anything has survived. You know, my husband laughs. He refers to it as our scrapbook, which doesn't exist. You know, we didn't keep anything. So it's a wonder that I had any of that stuff that is pictured in the book. It was really fun to go back through all that stuff and look at everything. But everything was, you know, destroyed. And now I know where to go, and we need some...
If you need one, I got one, right? I got it right here.
Yeah. Too bad I didn't know about it.
So when you became a journalist for Rolling Stone, you sort of gave your subjects enough rope and then you kind of stood back and watched them hang themselves. Was that your style?
I think that's my technique, such as it is. You know, it really arose from complete ignorance of journalism. And also new journalism kind of called for a kind of blank slate in a way, or to experience. I seem to enjoy stories where, when I read them, I felt like I was experiencing being there, like Joan Didion's work, which is my, you know, that's my... what I would aspire to and never quite, you know, ever be able to reach, no matter how hard I ever will try. But, you know, she would just really make you feel like you were there. And so that became what I tried to do in my way.
And,
so I suppose Hunter did that too, in his way.
Uh-huh. But of course, he's much more present in his stories than you are in
yes,
yours.
Yes, he is. And I was, you know, my writing teacher at Brown had been John Hawks. So I sent him my first article published, which was the Dennis Hopper article, because they held the Marvel Comics cover for the summer, and I think that was in April when I went to the Dennis Hopper thing, and I'd done some other stuff before even that. When I sent my writing teacher, John Hawks, my Dennis Hopper article, he wrote back that he liked the article, that he was amused. He found, he talked about my amusing anonymity. So I thought that was what I thought of journalism, that you weren't supposed to insert yourself in the story as a character. So I called myself the journalist and Annie the photographer. And it was kind of silly in a way, but I didn't mean it to be silly. I was doing my best. But basically, I recorded everything that went on because I knew I would be nervous going into this really harrowing circumstance with these very hipster people who were really stoned. I mean, not that I wasn't around a lot of being stoned, but this was really Hollywood and much harder edged, even though it was in Taos, New Mexico. The people were, I don't want to say they were sophisticated, but it was sort of like, I guess, what Andy Warhol's scene must have been like. It was scary to me. And so I tape recorded everything, so I had everything on tape. And the last third of the article was just the transcription, really, of the awfulness of it, until I fled into the desert at night and lived to tell about it. Live to write a long book about it.
I think you'll be shocked to hear, because I was looking at this online the other day and I saw that they are putting out a restored version of the last movie, as if it's some kind of a something that's...
No, you know, I'm not shocked, because I was walking down the street in Iowa City and there's an art film house here, and lo and behold, there was there it was, the last movie, and I thought, okay, so you've left. Last, you know. So he did have his movie on, yeah. I mean, it won the Venice Film Festival. It said there on the movie poster, so that sort of surprised me.
They must have all been on acid when they watched it. That's the only explanation.
Have you seen it?
No, I have to. I don't think I've ever seen it.
No, I don't think many people have seen it, but maybe, you know, it's one of those things that just needs 50 years.
Maybe.
To marinate, you know.
Maybe. I don't know. Okay, well, we'll have to see it. Well, as soon as the Blu-ray comes out, we'll watch it and talk about it again.
Yeah.
No, that won't happen. No. And what about you were the one who was interviewing. You were the presence in the famous David Cassidy article where he appeared nude on the cover, which kind of didn't help his career as much as he thought it would.
No, it didn't. I mean, he was and remained a kind of tragic figure, and you know, he self-pitying and with good reason. I mean, he couldn't really handle what happened to him in certain ways, and he was wounded, I think, by his father's inattention. I didn't know really that sort of thing, but he just struck me as a very, you know, sad figure, and used by the teen idol business, feeling used by the teen idol business, wanting very much to be taken seriously, but not having done anything serious yet, you know, or maybe ever, I don't know. But it didn't help him in the way he thought it would. And it was hurtful to him and I guess to his PR person whose idea it was that got fired. It was hurtful. You know, but it was mostly an article about, it was something about that, but it was also about, you know, in the quandary he was in, but it was also about the teen idol business and the TV, you know, how TV and Gloria Favor's, you know, teen idol magazines work. So, you know, we were paid by the word, what can I say? It was 10,000
No, it's. I think it's a very meaningful and interesting article. I just reread it, actually.
I like the article. I'm okay with the article. I think it was Annie's pictures that really put it, you know, over the edge, or put him over the edge, and put his sponsors over the edge, because it, you know, that little pubic hair and hair under the arms and stuff. It was also in gay bookstores the biggest selling Rolling Stone. I think it was the biggest selling Rolling Stone ever. Anywhere. So there you go.
Well, you know, there was, and I think it started sometime in the 80s, long after you left the magazine, and it's continuing to this day, that they're constantly putting scantily clad people on their cover.
Yeah, well, you know, yeah. I once asked a friend who published a book, what's that girl doing kneeling there half night? There's nobody in your book like that. And my friend said, she's selling books. So that, you know, that's that.
Well, in your book, you talk about your, I guess the reason that you ended up leaving Rolling Stone was this article that you were going to write about Robert Kennedy Jr.
No, it was the whole, it was all of the children of Robert Kennedy that I could get to, which was only the three adults. I didn't pursue the children. I didn't think that would be fair.
Well, see, now that's the thing. You know, you have a sort of a scruples that you're talking about in your book that are completely out of date now. You would never make it in journalism now.
Well, probably not, and I don't think I could afford it, you know. Well, although maybe, I don't know. I don't know how that scene is anymore. I really don't. I have friends that are journalists, and they seem to survive, but no, I wasn't really, my heart just wasn't in it. But this is, that article was the moment, you know, it was my third year on the masthead, though not writing for the magazine. I started in 70 and was on the masthead 3 years, and then I wrote for the magazine after I was off the masthead, so I filed my last story in 74, so I guess that's 4 years or 5 years or something. But, you know, I hadn't achieved anywhere near Hunter's fame, but I felt that the Children of Robert Kennedy article would have put me on a bigger stage. You know, it would have been picked up and noticed, maybe by Time magazine or some huge thing like that. But just because, you know, I found out a lot about the kids, and maybe some scruple did kind of surface there. I'm not sure why I felt why I did what I did, and I try to explain in the book why I actually went to bed with one of the children, but one of the adult children of that I was interviewing. So that is part of it. And I suppose I thought that would have put me on a bigger map too, but I just didn't want to go on a map that way. I just didn't want to. I felt embarrassed by it, and I chose to write about it now, just for that reason. I wanted to face it. I wanted to own what I had done, and let it be known, and reckon with it.
I'm Gary Shapiro. You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO. My guest this week is Robin Green. She's the author of The Only Girl: My Life and Times on the Masthead of Rolling Stone. In addition to writing for Rolling Stone, Robin Green had a 25-year career in television, where she won Emmys and Golden Globes for her work on The Sopranos, and she also created the police drama Blue Bloods. Well, you know, you mentioned Les Moonves earlier and the whole Me Too situation, and it's a complex problem in terms of looking at someone's whole life and seeing things that have happened. I mean, obviously certain people are predators and that's terrible, but there's also people who are being held accountable for behavior that was not in any way abnormal behavior.
Then.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there was a book written about Jan that just made him sound awful, but that wasn't my experience of him at all, or any of them. I mean, you know, Joe Esterhaus, yes, he's a macho guy. And Hunter, too, you know, but girls were different there then, too. I mean, in that place and time, you know, we had the pill. The pill had just, and I think women today can't imagine what it would have been like without it. But it had just happened, you know, and I remember coming to Pembroke and, you know, being in line, first in line at the, you know, infirmary, to get the pills, and also we were hippies and free love, and it was very empowering. There was no AIDS, and we just felt our behavior as freedom. We felt very powerful, I think. I can't remember a single incident then, and I talked to other girls who worked at Rolling Stone and other women now, and they can't either. I mean, you know, they didn't do anything they didn't want to do, and nobody made them. It just wasn't like that. It was pretty cool. It was just a friendly scene. And it was like that in Berkeley, too. I mean, it was just, you know, there's always going to be, there may be some bad apples, but I never experienced it.
Nobody ever put upon you?
No. And, you know, I've gotten out of some situations that I didn't like or pushed somebody away, but I pushed them away. I didn't, you know, there was just one person, and actually it was the father of one of my friends. So
that's bad.
It wasn't, yeah, it was just some horned dog, you know, but, you know, Gloria Steinem in the Times last Sunday told a great story about her Me Too movement. It was a job interview, or she was being interviewed in some capacity, and the man tried to kiss her, and she bit his cheek so hard that he bled. And she said, "I didn't think about it. I just did it." And so I think we were just fiercer in some way, because we were, like, you know, we felt that we were forging new ground then. It was just a different scene. It was a different world then, especially in our little corner of it, and in the counterculture in the Bay Area. It wasn't that way in New York, and I think that's one of the reasons I got out of there. At least I wasn't part of any kind of scene there that was that way. But I wanted to be part of what I was reading in Rolling Stone. I wanted to be in the Bay Area where it felt like it was happening.
You spend a page or so talking about what you wore to your interview at Rolling Stone.
Yeah. Not my secretarial disguise this time, right? No little Capizio shoes and pantyhose and that sort of thing. A restricting bra. But I wore, you know, my clothes. I wore a short denim mini skirt, and my sandals, and a T-shirt, and this jacket that I borrowed from a friend with a had a patch on the back of people fornicating. So it was kind of, you know, racy. And then I took my dog.
You took your dog with you to the interview?
I did. And when I got there, you know, to this really cool warehouse in this industrial neighborhood, nobody was there then, but, you know, but Rolling Stone and a bar across the street. But, you know, it was just this cool brick lofty looking thing. And I walked into the interview with a friend from Brown had given me the name of her old boss in publishing in New York, who was now the publisher of Rolling Stone's book division, Straight Arrow. And, you know, Alan Rinsler stands up, and his dog was in the office too. You know what I mean? So it was just like I had come home. And the rest was my little history.
Yeah. What about the music? Did music play a role in drawing you to Rolling Stone? I mean, it was a music.
Yeah.
Music.
Well, it was a role in drawing me into the world of the Bay Area and San Francisco. And, you know, music, when I went out with my boyfriend, we saw music in New York. We saw Janis Joplin when I lived in New York. We saw, you know, jazz in Chicago when I lived with him in Chicago. And, you know, Jimi Hendrix. And, you know, we listened to records. I would, you know, get stoned and read the liner notes, like, all night, you know, really slowly. But, you know, I just it was important to me what. And that's why I love Rolling Stone so much. I really cared what these musicians thought. They were my poets, and I wanted to know what they thought. I wanted to know what John Lennon thought. It was important to me. And so music played a huge part of my life then, of all of our lives. You know, I loved Neil Young afterwards. So I loved the Grateful Dead at the time, you know, hanging out with Jerry Garcia when Annie had a crush on him at some bar he was playing at in North Beach. And, oh, that was just a great time. You know, great time.
But you didn't get a tattoo? No tattoos?
No, because, Annie gave me for my 27th birthday, she gave me a certificate for a $20 tattoo at Lyle Tuttle's Tattoo Parlor in North Beach, but I didn't. No. Unfortunately, I miss the whole tattoo thing now, or I'd be covered. I'd become old lady with like a million tattoos all over her body. So.
Yeah, Lyle Tuttle is still there.
Oh, is he really?
Yeah.
Is he really? Wow. That is amazing. Well, he must be as old as me. maybe even older, right?
I'm going to say he's older.
I was born in 45, so this is really the history of a girl growing up in the 50s and getting through all of that.
It's almost like you wrote three books, because you wrote a book about a Jewish girl growing up in the East Coast, and then you wrote a book about the person that worked for Rolling Stone, and then you wrote a book about working in television.
I couldn't help it. I mean, it just sort of wrote itself in a way. I just wanted, I have done all this stuff, and this was the book that I was going to write, and it just kind of took over. The writing of it took over. It dictated its own terms. And that was what was the most exciting thing. I'd never written anything that long, and I had to learn just a whole bunch of different new skills, like patience. I learned to be patient and not to try and control it too much. And I wanted to honor people. I wanted to honor the people that I've lost along the way, who died, a lot of them, and whom I've lost also in other ways. So this was my chance to be known, to make myself known, to declare something. Do you have anything to declare? Yes, I do. I have a whole lot of transgressions, and I have a lot of love to declare, and I have some achievements to declare. It was in a way my declaration, and I'd love to say that it was tremendously freeing, but it's sort of nerve-wracking not knowing how people will respond, and that's why when you say you loved it, it made me so happy.
Oh, I think it's one of the greatest books I've ever read, seriously.
I do too.
but let me ask you this. How did one thing prepare you for the next thing? Like, did working at Rolling Stone prepare you for television? I mean, you didn't think, oh, I'll go into TV now.
I didn't have a TV. I didn't have a TV until I was 34. My parents came to visit me in L.A. and said, it's awfully quiet in here. Where's your TV? I just didn't watch it. And then, of course, once you get one, you just watch it all the time. And it becomes like you're an addict to it. But it never occurred to me, just as I had never imagined writing for a magazine, that I would be the one to write it. But boy, when I had the chance, I sure leapt at it. I spent 25 years in television. It was really a whole career late in life. I started when I was 40.
One of the touching things I found in your book is when you mentioned that your father had passed away before you became a well-known television.
Yeah, that was tough. Yeah. Well, it was tough because, he didn't get to see me happy. He didn't get to see me settled, married, awarded. He didn't get to go to the Emmys. That's really what I regret, because he loved that world, the world of entertainment. They loved those late night shows, Jack Parr and Johnny Carson and all that. He would have flipped out in those, limos and stuff. And he was a bit of a boulevardier in his youth in Providence. He had the tuxedo and was the man about town with no money, but, sort of Mr. Bojangles trying to charm his way around. But he loved that. He still had his tux and it would have fit, and he would have had a ball. But he died. He died right before it. Too bad, right?
Yeah. You're such a marvelous storyteller, not only in this book, The Only Girl, but also, you told us about Tony Soprano's childhood and all the crazy stories that you've told, both made up and true. So are you going to write a novel now?
It's really funny that you should ask that, because, we spent the winter in St. John, and that's where I wrote most of this book, needing to work and, wanting to work. Not so much needing anymore, except really psychologically or some part of me that needs to. And so I was thinking I would try, but I haven't the faintest idea to do it. You know, somebody asked me to write this book, Only Girl, so, you know, if you tell me what novel to write, I'll write it. I think this I have to do for myself.
So when you were writing for The Sopranos, for instance, you know, you thought of things that no one else thought of for Tony Soprano. You know, where did that come from? Isn't that the same place that you would find your novel?
Well, yeah. I mean, my husband says it's a matter of focus. And that if you are patient, and you know, you have to be sitting there trying. So I intend to try. I'm superstitious, so I'm afraid that if I say it, it won't happen.
So, and maybe there's not the same kind of, I mean, each of the things that you did in each of the phases of your life were driven by a certain necessity, right?
A necessity to do something. I mean, the minute Sopranos happened, you know, I don't need to work in the way I did when I was younger, you know, to pay the rent. The rent's paid. So there's some other reason why I write, you know, there's some other reason why I work. I think it's not that I enjoy it. That's kind of the wrong word for something that comes hard. But I like having written. I mean, what writer doesn't say that, you know? So I think I'm reading this wonderful book now called Asymmetry, and I can't remember the name of the writer, but one of the characters in the book is a writer, and he says writers need creative people need four things. They need irony, melancholy, a little bit of competition, a feeling of wanting to compete, and boredom. And I was like, check, 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 you know? Yeah. So I have all of those things. I have all of those things. And I think, but, you know, a lot of it, like wanting to succeed, wanting to be competitive, wanting to prove something. Sure, I'll cop to that. It's not the, you know, it's not the nicest motivation, but that's there, certainly. Just wanting to compete, wanting to do something notable or good. I'm embarrassed to say that, I guess, a little bit. I'll stop. Do you know what I'm talking about? Do other writers say this? Or
similar things, I think. Yeah.
Okay. Yes. I mean, you can, you know, your listeners will get the impression that I just don't hold back, you know.
And you
I
don't.
I was thinking of calling the book TMI. I'm surprised nobody used that title, you know. But I want to be honest, you know. I do want to be honest. I think it's important to tell the truth as much as you can. And one of the hard things about writing a book is that afterwards you discover maybe there was more to it.
That maybe you could have spent more time in certain areas of it.
Well, just, you know, I didn't stop growing or thinking when I finished the book, but the book is finished. So, you know,
Volume 2, The Only Girl, Part 2.
Yeah. I think fiction. Okay. Yeah.
A novel about a girl from Rhode Island. All right, this book is called The Only Girl, My Life and Times on the Masthead of Rolling Stone. The author is Robin Green. And when I got to the end of this book, I was very upset that I had gotten to the end because I wanted it to just keep going. And I thank you so much for spending some time talking to me on From the Bookshelf.
I had so much fun talking to you. I hope we get to talk again with my next book.
Yes, with your novel. That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Robin Green. Her new book, you should read it. It's called The Only Girl, My Life and Times on the Masthead of Rolling Stone. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.